The series finale of Parks and Recreation is over, but we are just getting started here on post-show recaps. Hey, everyone. Mike Bloom here in a, I have to admit, a slight state of mourning here. We are here to eulogize and celebrate the series that was Parks and Recreation, and I am joined by a man who I don't believe has stopped wearing black for the past 48 hours, Antonio Mazzaro. Antonio, how are you in this moment of crisis?
It's tough. You said Parks and Recreation is over just then, and I got a lump in my throat. It's like I don't know. I've denied it. I've bargained. I've done all these things that I guess at some point I'm going to have to come to acceptance, but I'm not getting there. The hardest part for me is seeing the gag reel at the end of the credits. Like, that's a wrap for Parks and Recreation series wrap, man. It's really tough, but I'll get through it in these dark times. And this, our national nightmare is just beginning, but hopefully it will be very short.
Will it take you until 2017 to accept the fact that Parks and Recreation is over?
It might, or 2021, or 2023, or 2045, or somewhere in there, yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll be two old men sitting on whatever, like, laser plane that that Craig and Typhoon were on, and we'd be complaining about the exact same things about the show.
My dibs on Typhoon.
All right, I like Billy Eichner. I'll go with Craig.
All right.
At the time we're recording this, a little less than 48 hours ago, the hour-long Parks and Recreation finale aired. Actually, just a short time ago before we're recording this, the producer's cut was released of this episode. So just as a word of warning to those of you that have only seen the network aired episode, Antonio and I have watched the producer cut episode, and there are, as we discovered, not only, you know, 10 minutes of extra footage, but several character future storylines that we did not see in the original cut. So just a fair warning, there's a good chance that we'll talk about a couple of these one-off characters that we end up seeing their future, which is a lot of fun. And I'm super glad that they released this, because not only did it include a lot more jokes, I felt like this was the episode that the producers wanted to make after all.
Yeah, you Shauna Mulway tweep fans out there should probably tune out if you haven't seen the producer's cut, because we're going to spoil the hell out of what happens to her.
And it is delightful.
It's quite delightful. Do you want some gum, Mike?
Oh, man. All right. Let's go right down to City Hall right now, Antonio.
Let's do it. 5 hours from now, we can get this cooked up.
Give me your impressions about the episode in general before we take a deep dive here, Antonio. Were you on the pro side, the con side, mixed? What are your thoughts on it?
So pro. I couldn't have been more pro. Honestly, not that I had any trepidation. Parks and Recreation has had to write finales, though, so many times because they've been unsure if they're getting renewed or not and exactly what might become of the series future, that they've really kind of fired a ton of finale bullets. The Bye-Bye Little Sebastian episode especially is really kind of like a high note in terms of series finales that were just season finales. And so it was difficult. I think they'd kind of expended a lot of their energy on these previous season finales. So I really love that they went with a conceit on this one, borrowed, I think, from the last few minutes of HBO's Six Feet Under, mm-hmm. and flashing forward into the futures of these characters' lives. It's perfect for Parks and Rec because it has that great blend of sentimentality. It plays with the conceit they established at the beginning of the season with the time jump. It allows them to do more, you know, clever societal commentary and kind of throwaway lines. And it really lets you kind of participate in the lives of these characters after the show's off the air somehow. And I love that. I love that.
It's basically like the ending of Six Feet Under, except dragged out to an hour and with much, much less old age makeup.
Yeah, and less dying, really. I mean, ultimately, I think that there's a little bit that goes on in there, but not too much.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, I think it was fortunately or unfortunately, the Parks and Recreation production crew has had a lot of opportunities in practice in writing possible series finales. And I think, you know, this really did feel like the final one. But I think it had a fantastic mix of humor, pathos, heartwarming moments. I will say I don't think it was, you know, the most outrageously funny episode, but I am totally fine with that, because I think if you focus too much on like the uproariously funny and you don't focus so much on like the characters and the heart of it, then that's not really what the show is about. And I just enjoyed all the little send-offs that each character got. And so, you know, I'll say that for, you know, 2000s NBC comedies, Between this and 30 Rock and The Office, I would say they're NBC's batting 2-for-3 right now in final episodes.
Oh, you didn't like the 30 Rock finale?
Oh, no. Oh, that's an incorrect guess there, Mr. Mazzaro.
Yeah, I figured it was. It's OK. Look, Parks and Recreation is not a show that overstayed its welcome by any stretch. I don't think anybody would say that. There were some times in previous seasons, especially near the end of the run, where things were getting a little slow, maybe, even though they had great kind of overall season arcs. There were some times where it's like, okay, we're just going to see these characters kind of in similar scenarios here that we've seen them before. But the time jump really injected a lot of energy into the show and gave them a lot more to play with. And unlike 30 Rock, which had kind of a lull, a real lull, I think, in the middle of the series and then really came back by the end of it, I don't know that Parks and Rec's lull was as great, but I think the finish was just as strong. Whereas The Office just fizzled out. Like, oh, man, that was brutal. That was like the end of disco music.
Yeah, 30 Rock and Parks and Rec could definitely be talked about in the same vein in terms of final seasons. And I agree. I think 30 Rock had much lower lows as compared to Parks and Rec. I would say that, like, you know, when Parks and Rec season one aside found its quote unquote lower ground, maybe around like season 5 or 6 or so, when it felt like they were kind of running things into a rut a little bit. I thought in both cases, the final season just put like a jolt of energy. It was almost like, you know, NBC kind of tasered the writers in the side a little bit to say, like, okay, wake up, this is your last, this is you know, last mile of the marathon, let's just give it everything you've got. And you know, this is a really creatively fueled season, and I know we've talked about this in previous podcasts, but I love how they are able to like reinvigorate a lot of things and give things so much heart. I mean, we're going to talk about this when we're probably going to incorporate elements from the last 8 episodes into this podcast, but even talking about an episode like Leslie and Ron, still having those really heartbreaking emotional elements in there that is really trademark to the show, while at the same time retaining its humor, is really what the show is all about. And I feel like the writers were really able to focus on that while still peppering in a lot of those like 2017 references where they can be ridiculous and be cartoony and make references to the fact that, you know, they rebooted Hitch, you know, and that there were on our 10th Fast and the Furious movie, Tokyo Drift 3. You know, I think this season overall, I was thrilled with it. I think we'll talk a little bit. The Grizzle stuff, it's probably the lowest point in the season for me, but even that, I still was able to enjoy to some extent.
Yeah, and I think that there's some desire to parody some things and to kind of feature some different characters and some different moments and have another wedding, have some funerals, like have the kind of things that you might expect. It's kind of interesting. They wrote a lot of, I think, character finales into the series, like the Johnny Karate Super Awesome Musical Explosion Show episode. So I think they really got to do sort of whatever they wanted. April got her own real episode about finding herself. And it's funny, earlier on, I'd post show recaps here. We've podcasted about Parks and Recreation twice so far this season. First after the kind of first two episodes, and then again after the second two episodes. And I think after the second two episodes, our kind of perspective was, wow, where's this season going to go now that Leslie and Ron are back together? That seemed like it was going to be a major arc for this season. And so then the Grizzle thing got put to bed relatively quickly. And yeah, it's like, and what next, else is
in the,
there
in the next two episodes?
Yeah, it's like, what else is there? But then they really just nailed, I think, the kind of character moments and kind of we can talk on as we get forward here about some of those other episodes in the season as a whole. But it is very interesting the way they chose to go about this final season. And I think the energy was great. It's a shame there wasn't a little bit more. But I more and more, I'm starting to think that 22 episodes is just so many episodes. And I know syndication drives a lot, and I know it's difficult, but I also know the model is changing. And I just wonder if Parks and Rec could have been a half season show for 3 or 4 more years with these great bursts and these great kind of sprints, if it wouldn't have been something that had more legs. But, you know, I'm very happy with how the show played out. So, I was looking at an ad about Friends earlier, and it said that there were 236 episodes of Friends, and they were all on Netflix. And there's just no chance, and this is not an affront to Friends, but there's just no chance that those 236 episodes are all like A+ episodes. Mm-hmm. So to have a final season of 12 episodes where most of them were really, really, really good. I think it's a great statement of the writers of Parks and Recreation, but it's also reflective of the fact that they only had to do 12 episodes. So they could really stick as much as they could into those 12 episodes and really make them great.
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with the quantity of episodes as much as I had a problem with NBC, doubling up. It seems like, I don't know if NBC has a vendetta against me or something with these NBC shows that I love. They decide to double them up on this season. But I think that's part of the reason probably why you wanted to go for longer is because they took something that would ostensibly last an entire spring season and pushed it over the course of a month and a half, which wasn't great. Granted, they were half hour episodes, so they flew by. But still, I mean, I think it was such a good season that I would enjoy, tasting half an hour every week until May. I would have been a fan of that personally.
Yeah, and I agree. I completely agree. And look, NBC can be criticized for a lot, and fairly or unfairly, but the NBC is the same network that has given us seven seasons of Parks and Recreation. So, mm-hmm. However I got my 125 episodes of Parks and Recreation, I'm happy to get it, because it could have been canceled after six or 24 or 30, or it could have been canceled after season three, after season four. This was a show that was constantly on watch, as we've noted. So the fact that NBC has given us what they gave us, it's easy to criticize them for scheduling and burn-offs and time slots and lead-ins and all of that. But hey, seven seasons is nothing to sneeze at, man. That's fantastic.
It's one past six seasons in a movie, so
it really is. And I'm all for movies, so let's do it. And you never know when this group of people could be back together again.
That's Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
It could be. We have Star-Lord, yeah, and maybe they're facing off against someone evil like Dennis Feinstein. He's got an Infinity Stone and he's trying to make a cologne out of it. I don't know. Could happen.
Perfect. So I figured, the finale set us up in a really fun way of, as we talked about before, taking each of these individual characters. And I just have to say that I loved the camera blocking choice of like Leslie literally touching these people. And it leads into kind of a tangent about what their life is after 2017, because this episode takes place basically on the last day before everyone kind of goes their separate ways. Ben and Leslie, Andy and April are all going to Washington. Donna is going to Seattle. I believe everyone else stays in Pawnee, but nobody works in the Parks Department anymore, so they're going to take off to their separate vocations. But I love this image that, like, Leslie did touch these characters in a certain way, and they've kind of been imbued with her qualities or imbued with a relationship in certain ways. And I love that physical touching leading to, like, Leslie touched them, and this is what happened to them in the future. So the show set up this really nice thing of, over a series of characters over this hour-long episode, we got to see their futures play out. And I thought this would be a nice opportunity. I'll go through each character, we'll talk about their 2017 plus storylines, and then we can probably tie it into those latter eight episodes that we weren't able to podcast about, because as you said, Antonio, a lot of these characters, April and Andy got their own episodes, Donna got her own episodes, Gary got like a bunch of moments in between episodes, Ben got an entire storyline in those last eight episodes, so there is definitely a lot to talk about. So let's dive in. Let's start talking about the glorious future.
Yeah, let's do it. And if that includes Leslie Knope as a sort of proto Jacob from Lost, and all these people are candidates and she's touching them in some way, let's go for it.
Absolutely. You know, there is like a cave, but maybe like some sort of like carved out wall in the basement that has the names of all of her workers on there.
Oh, I really wish there had been a lighthouse that all of a sudden showed up at the end of this series in Pawnee. That would have been fantastic.
I don't think I would be able to love the show anymore until that moment.
until that moment. OK, I got it. After that moment is what I thought you were going to say, but that's fine.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. It's just the show. You're right about the touching, and having that be a metaphor and as well as a physical action. And that is something that on the first watch didn't really kind of shine through to me. But watching it a second time in the way it's kind of set up is gorgeous. It's like incredible. And sometimes it's a hug. Sometimes it's a tap. Sometimes it's holding hands on the swing set with Ron Swanson, which is just gutting. So it's really great how that was all set up, for sure.
So let's start off with Donna. We can talk a little bit about Donna's future. So Donna ended up moving to Seattle and she sells She's selling real estate. We get a nice little, 2017 plus humor here, where apparently they've built the Seattle haystack around the Seattle space, or the Seattle space haystack around the Space Needle, so that you can barely see the Space Needle. And this is an interesting one, because Joe, who's played by Keegan-Michael Key, who Donna married about halfway through the season, is, I guess, going through some sort of budgetary cuts at the school where they just got rid of math. I'm not sure who the president is at this time, but clearly they don't care for math. So Donna sets up this foundation to basically treat Joe, to have Joe treat himself to math. So Antonio, do you have any sort of thoughts about this? And I guess we can tie it back into the Donna and Joe episode as well, with Donna's wedding.
Yeah, Donna's wedding and Donna and Joe and everything that kind of came from that is sort of a culmination of this character that played incredibly by Retta, who, with along with Jerry, played by Jim O'Hare, was sort of cast in the sort of background role like you would see on The Office. You see these characters cast where they're not exactly sure what they want out of that character yet, and they're not exactly sure what they want to do with that character yet, but they know they like them and they want to put them on the show. So that's all they knew really about Donna when they brought Donna in the door and kind of featured her in the background of the early parts of the series. But as it evolved, I think a lot of what Donna did were traits that were true to Retta. Retta is fantastic on Twitter. She's at Unforrettable. If you don't follow her, she live tweets things all the time, just like Donna. There's a lot of those elements with her. And there was this great sort of like crazy baller, like world VIP lifestyle that Donna lived secretly. She was always doing all, if it started out with, she had a Mercedes and she loved her Mercedes and she didn't want anybody hurting her car. But then it became, She was in Vogue. She used to be in Vogue. Is that what we picked up in this episode? Yeah, this finale?
Technically, I think it wasn't that she left En Vogue. It was that it wasn't that she left En Vogue. It was like En Vogue she made En Vogue leave her or something.
Yeah,
like that.
She wasn't kicked out of En Vogue. She kicked them out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that's hilarious. She was ninth place on Italy's Got Talent. She was in a NASCAR pit crew. She DJ'd a boat party in Venezuela. So Donna still has all these trappings and elements of her character that they really evolved over the course of the series. But in order to kind of bring her some kind of arc, we have Donna sort of accepting that you don't have to live that lifestyle your whole life. You don't have to be that baller. You can, somebody that actually wants to treat you nice can actually make you happy, and you can be happy with them. And so earlier in the season, we had her marrying Joe, which was a great character note for her, because Donna was the sort of, I've got a thing going on with somebody from the fire department. I got a thing going on with this other guy. She was kind of this serial player. And like, you'd see her in the Snakehole Lounge. You'd see her just sitting there with four or five guys in a booth. That's Donna. That's Donna Meagle. But now she's sitting down with Joe and settling down, and that's all well and good. So in the future, it's one step further that she's willing to take money that's her money, that's the sort of thing she spends on herself, and actually spend it on someone else. That is like the ultimate evolution of Donna. That's like if she were a Pokemon, she's at the end of her cycle. Like, that's fantastic.
Yeah, considering that her main thing that people remember her for is the treat yourself.
Treating herself, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Which is like, I'm going to take a day where I just spend all money on stuff that I want. I agree. I think it's a great progression of her character. And I really enjoyed the Donna and Joe episode as well, because you could also see glimpses of that too. I think it's weird, but I think though the most heartwarming moment of that episode is where Donna, quote unquote, misspells at that time Terry's nameplate to read Gary. And I thought that was like such, it was weird. It was like one of the most like heartwarming moments I felt on that season, was because, you could tell that she knew that it was his real name the whole time. And she definitely felt a lot of his anguish that he was going through the multiple name changes and, being the butt monkey of the office. And I did enjoy the stuff in the next series of episodes too, when like she, stayed after work and like hung out with him all because he dropped his keys down the drain. I thought that was nice. But for some reason, that one moment spoke so much about not only their relationship, but like who Donna progressed to as a character. And it was so interesting because, when Tom was going through that book presentation, one of the things I caught when he said, like, you could be a Donna, I think one of the qualities was like mysterious. And that's what the character was for so long, was like this woman who like had all these talents, and Genuine was her cousin, and who is Donna and what's going on with Donna. So again, kudos to these writers for really like ending up fleshing out who this character is. She's not some sort of like mystery lady who's able to do it all. She, you know, she had a few episodes in there besides Donna and Joe. I think she had an episode in the sixth season where like her and Leslie had a real bonding moment. But I mean, the Retta really grew into her own, and I grew to really enjoy the character, and I completely agree with you in terms of the progression. I love that it's kind of led to her setting up this foundation for Joe, and you know, someone that she really didn't seem to care about in the sixth season. They've really grown into a loving relationship, was something really fun. But I still love that she kept those elements of her character, like buying that diamond watch and, you know, being the HBIC and assisting Tom with making Tom's Bistro a franchise. So I think all these final characters get A pluses, but I'm really appreciative of what they ended up doing with Donna.
Yeah, it's funny because if you look back, the Penguin Wedding episode, Pawnee Zoo, at the beginning of season two, the gays in Pawnee who want to celebrate Leslie Knope, Donna says, "Are you looking good, Knope? You're going to turn somebody tonight." And Leslie's talking head is like, "That is hands down the single best interaction I've ever had with Donna." And it's like, that was just a stray line where Donna paid her a compliment on how she was looking. But like, that's where Donna was at the beginning of this interaction. She was mysterious. She wasn't close to her coworkers in that regard. She did have crushes on Chris Pratt throughout and kind of remarked on how she thought he was attractive. There was a nice callback to that in this episode when she was kind of saying, Macklin's always the hottest. Like, she's still got a little bit of a thing for Chris Pratt, even though he's taken. And even though the Andy and April are perfect, she's always thought that Andy was attractive. So attractive, but so dumb, as she put at one point, I think. So I really did like that. And you're dead on about the moment at the wedding. And then the great little coda to that, when she and Gary have that just sweet moment where there's no real other reason to have it except that it's sweet, where he's lost his wedding ring and she orders food and they sort of reminisce about the times when they used to work together. She's always looked at Jerry as a hilarious observer when he was licking the campaign envelopes for Leslie's campaign. Yeah. Yeah. And she's kind of sitting on the side. She cancels a date because she's like, I got to see this. And she just sits there and watches him do it. So she's always sort of been in awe of Gary. And I think actually kind of found him like Ben has a little bit more valuable than others. And I think that some of that was probably a subtle way of saying, like, you and I were the sort of bench characters. We weren't the series regulars always. We had to be promoted to that. And this wasn't always our show, but we've been on it from the jump, basically. But we have that kind of shared bond in common. So I think that was part of it, too, is that it was natural to write that sort of shared bond between them because they were those sort of outside characters compared to the core group for a while. So I did like all the stuff they did with Donna. It also made sense to me that she was one of the ones they dispensed with earlier in the episode, because I think people want to know what happens with Donna, but that's certainly not the piece de resistance of the mm-hmm. episodes. Like, we love the character. We love Donna. It was a great way to start it, though, because it was like, okay, so this finale is going to have some stray jokes about haystacks and space needles and all that, but it's also going to have very, very sweet moments that are sort of like, epilogues are hard. How do you write an epilogue when you've already brought the character to such a wonderful place? And this was literally a cherry on top when she did the treat yourself kind of program, or teach yourself. That was really great for her, considering the kind of ending to the character we'd already been given with the wedding. The arc ends there, but it continues in such a great way in this episode. And yeah, I love that moment with the name. That's such a great way to kind of bring that full circle.
Speaking of weddings, should we touch briefly upon Craig's very shortly timed out future here with his now? So this whole thing with Typhoon, granted, we've seen Craig maybe like 4 or 5 times this season, which I was sad about, but you know, I can understand he's a character that isn't for everyone, and they probably want to instill him in small doses to not make him too ingratiating. But I love that they've kind of played out this whole Typhoon arc, because we actually see, you know, the two of Typhoon tries to flirt with Craig in the episode Donna and Joe, and you know, Craig very quickly affirms to like, I think he's like I'm interested but I'm not into it right now. So I love the fact that in this future, you know, he ends up serenading the crowd at Tom's Bistro, which is fantastic. I love that Billy Eichner is able to bring out those random talents. But I love the fact that he ends up relenting and falling in love with Typhoon. And there's so many fun things about this storyline, too. There's Horatio Sanz as the priest. And it's honestly, looking back on it, it's odd that we hadn't seen Horatio Sanz in a guest starring role before, considering how close him and Amy Poehler were, what with UCB and everything. But I loved Ron as the best man at the wedding, considering that that's only a callback to like the previous episode when you know, Ron forms a quick relationship with Typhoon about how much he hates Europeans and bicycles. And you know, it's just a very sweet, quick little coda of like, even in his old age, Craig, and being served John Ralphio champagne, Craig is always complaining.
Yeah, like this trout, that was hilarious. That was a great little line. Like, I've still have things, the mistakes that I've made most recently, this trout, when he said that on the plane. I thought that was really funny, because seeing that was the first kind of use of old age makeup in this episode. Seeing the character's future stretched out that far was really kind of sad. That ending on a joke was a nice comeback from that. So yeah, I like that we had that. I'll tell you, it really is a shame, because I think what people's complaints about Craig were was that he was just shouting all the time, and that's funny for a while, but I think it gets a little bit grating after a time, and it certainly was grating to me. But introducing Dr. Richard Nygaard, who knows who Dr. Richard Nygaard ever was? Maybe the most spoken about character who was never seen on screen. But introducing Dr. Richard Nygaard and into Craig's life, and having Craig kind of deal with that and be Craig, but kind of tuned down a little bit, was great. Like, they figured Craig out. It's just a shame that it took him until that season to really kind of twist that character note slightly, so that Craig was a lot, not just shouting all the time. Like, I think that it works so much. I know Billy Eichner's Billy on the Street stuff is, there's a lot of shouting involved, and there's a lot of intensity, and it's funny and it's quick. And I don't think we want to lose sight of that, but I think they were able to calibrate Craig correctly in this final season. And I was nice that we got a sort of little final send off there. And you're right, the joke with Ron being Typhoon's best man, very funny. Weird to see Horatio Sanz show up. I don't know why it was weird to me, but it very much was. He doesn't obviously look the way he's always looked, and he almost was incognito. In fact, it took me a while to figure it, to realize it was him. And so that was a great cameo. These weddings on Parks and Rec in this final season have had great cameos. We also had all the Meagles on Donna and Joe. Genuine show up, Genuine being pretty funny, and all the drama that April was trying to stop. And then at the end, almost in just right at the very end of the episode, we had the great cameo from Questlove playing Donna's often talked about brother Lavandrius, who she had a beef with over a microwave, and he brings the microwave back and slams it to the ground.
Smashes it, yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It was just, that was total fan service. It was a great, you know, celebrity cameo, but I mean, that's the kind of so typical of this season of Parks and Rec, is that they were like, what would we really like to do? Like, let's look at our bucket list of things we want to put on this show. Okay, if Donna's getting married, we want to see Meagles, and we got to see Lavandrius. And they probably said, who do we want to get to play that role? And I'm sure Questlove was their first call. So I love the way that all played out. And so, in kind of a smaller version of that, at Craig and Typhoon's wedding, having Ron kind of pop into the frame there, that was great. I mean, it's just this show can reference back on itself at this point. It's firing on all cylinders, so it knows, like, oh, we left that open. That would be a great way to cap that joke off. And that's sort of the Arrested Development kind of thing, where you don't even realize you're setting up jokes. Yeah. until you bring them full circle and you finish the joke several episodes later. So having Ron pop in there is a great example of that, and I just think that's awesome.
So let's segue here into April and Andy, which is definitely more on the emotional side than the humor side, which is very interesting, because the characters of Andy and April are largely meant to be more comic relief, with the exception, you know, I think a lot of the April stuff this season was a little more on the emotional side, but this was like a whole like play in over the course of like 7 minutes, essentially. Just to do a quick recap, so, you know, they're living in DC. April is presumably working for that job that she found, which I believe helps find, you know, young people jobs at other organizations. We still don't know what Andy does, but I'm sure he's on like public access doing Johnny Karate or something. But it seems like they have kids on the brain, and April is very hesitant about it because she has this weird theory in her brain that her children will come out in the opposite mannerism that they will. So considering the fact that she considers herself an Andy cool, that they're going to be lame. Leslie has this really just simple and touching metaphor for her about how, you know, having children is basically like building more members of your team. And if you want to add another team member, then that's the way to do it. But you guys are a team, and that's all it is. And I guess that convinces her, as sometime later they have little baby Jack. I'll abbreviate his name since I don't know the
yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, the fully, it's like a ticky ticky tembo type of thing. But they ended up, you know, having it quote unquote on Halloween. We found out in the producer's cut that it's actually November 1st, but Andy gets it pushed back. But I thought this was really, really touching. And I love it because I feel like it's been a while since we've seen something really touching between the two of them. We see glimpses of it in the Johnny Karate show, which I'm sure I'd love to talk about because that's such an interesting episode of Parks in general. But, you know, we've seen like their wedding episode was touching. I like the episode where April drives Andy to the Grand Canyon during that bucket list episode. But they're not, as I said, they're not usually known as these emotional characters. So to have April kind of really grow up over the course of this show and really deal with the situation that's a very mature is it was so interesting on a variety of levels. And I you know, Aubrey Plaza and Chris Pratt give fantastic performances across the board, and I thought they really knocked it out of the park on this one.
Yeah, again, I think it continues on a theme. I think once you have the episode in this season where you've got Mrs. Ludgate Dwyer goes to Washington, and April finally realizes after not only the what we've seen for April, her arc is she's an intern who hated working at the Parks Department. And then she realized she wanted to be Ron's assistant. And it seemed like at the time, a big part of that was she liked Andy and she wanted to stay around the office. But she was a good fit for Ron, and that's why that worked. But that's why she wanted to stay around. She didn't want to stay around because she loved the Parks Department. She liked Andy Dwyer, and that's why she wanted to be there. And then throughout, she sort of moved to Leslie's office because that made sense to her, and because kind of people were jumping ship and things were changing, and Leslie was always kind of her mentor, so that was fine. But the realization that she has in this season when she's thinking, well, this is not what I want to do, and it's time for me to find what I want to do. When she finally does figure that out and she gets the job at that organization, and she's going to be placing people in community organizations across the country and telling them what to do and talking to them once and never having to see them again and so forth and so on. All the funny yet also sweet things about why she wants that job. You've ended the character's arc. She's gotten there. She's gone from not having a clue what she wanted, kind of being a silly, immature, not wanting to help others, not caring about others person, to ending up with as a person who is literally taking care of other people, has affirmed what her career choice is and has gone out and found it after searching and come to that. So what do we do in the final episode if we want an epilogue for that character? Well, it's like, how do we advance one step further beyond that? Because even though she's happy in her career, she's having a hard time accepting other aspects of adulthood and shedding some of the things that have been sort of her defense mechanism or her safety blanket up till that point. And so, again, fantastic epilogue. It's you finish the character's arc, but let's take it one step further and let's talk about this issue. And kids are a great way to do that because Chris Pratt, Andy Dwyer has always loved kids. He's a kid himself in many ways. And Johnny Karate and him interacting with kids and her kind of feeling guilty for taking him away from that. That all seems so perfectly seamless to me that he would love kids and want them and that she wouldn't. It is a very natural, organic storyline. It's not like they forced some drama here. Like this is something that is a perfectly acceptable and believable scenario for these characters to find them in or find themselves in a few years down the road. And so I think that that's, again, just brilliant, sharp, really smart stuff. And no, the idea of the story itself isn't, it's not a funny scenario. It's more of a, like a smart scenario. There was a lot of humor in it. Andy eating the candy, Andy kind of being disappointed when Ben brings gifts to the hospital and they're not for him. Very, very funny. Andy kind of slunking around in the house when he realized Ben and Leslie's kids aren't there. Like, Andy had a lot of fun, I think, with what was going on with the kids' storyline. And just all real aspects of that with him were great. And I absolutely love, like, there were Easter eggs aplenty as well. Like, when he answers the door for the trick-or-treaters. Did you see one of the trick-or-treaters was dressed as Star-Lord?
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. If you see it, if you guys watch it again, or if you watch it again, Mike, when he opens the door to the trick-or-treaters, look on the left side and there's a kid with a red jacket on and a Star-Lord mask. And
so now we live in a world where, wait, then who played Star-Lord? Oh, this stuff always confuses me.
Yeah, no, I don't know either. And it's not something I want to spend too much time on, but maybe Andy Dwyer has become Chris Pratt. I don't know. Like, it's entirely possible that we've just essentially had a crossover and that's what it is. He always wanted to be Macklin. He always wanted to be all these other different things that ultimately he's acted out his favorite movies. I like to think, Mike, that when you say who knows what he's doing, if he's not actually crossed over and become Chris Pratt, I like to think he's part of the post-show recaps team with you and I, and he's just getting on and telling his versions of what happened in TV shows and movies. It's a perfect job for him.
I love that. Though it has to be musical, like what he did with Sudden Death starring Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah. He can do it musical, or he could do it when he was talking about Roadhouse. I think when the debate episode, when the TV cable wasn't working and he goes through that whole long thing. So yeah, listen, this guy's multi-talented. He could do lots of things in that regard. So Chris Pratt, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on the post-show recaps team. You don't even have to be Andy Dwyer. You can be Chris Pratt.
Absolutely. Well, let's go a little tangential here. And I want to talk about the Johnny Karate episode, if only for a few minutes, because it is such a different episode in terms of format from every single episode of Parks before and after it, which is interesting. And the cast really, the crew really let go with all, you know, they really like, you know, rip roared fired everything with this episode, considering like the Pawnee commercials that were in it and the way the show is formatted and, you know, all like the production gaffes that were going on as well and all like the little Easter eggs going on. It was so interesting for them to like really spend a whole entire episode just like skewing public access television. But then again, you still have that nugget of heart in it in terms of like April is really sad watching Andy have to go through his last show. But, you know, Andy is being his typical happy puppy dog Andy and saying like, you know what, I'm in support of you. And, you know, I'm happy wherever I am with you. And it's really nice that we went back to those characters as well, because, again, we hadn't seen too much of them in terms of character progression these past few seasons. What did you think about the Johnny Karate episode? Did you enjoy the change of format from everything else in this season?
I did. I gotta say one of the best things about it for sure was those commercials on the bumper from Ron Swanson's like very good building company commercial, where he's having issues with truth in advertising. So he didn't want to use any puffery or advertising terms. He just wanted to strictly and directly state what his company was and be done with it. I also like, because we had the kind of future jump, and because Mike Schur, the creator and showrunner of Parks and Recreation, co-creator and showrunner of Parks and Recreation, I think one of his favorite books, I believe he owns the film rights to it, is Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, which is set, you know, in a kind of the near present at the time. And it was this North American kind of dystopic society where years and calendars and months are sponsored by corporations. And there's this sort of just backgrounds about the way corporations operate. When I was first watching the Johnny Karate episode, I'm fast forwarding, but not through the commercials. I mean, we're a couple breaks in and I'm like, okay, I don't want to watch the commercials at this point, but I'm realizing that there are great commercials for Pawnee related things like Paunch Burger or Sweetums or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, oh, this is obviously a Verizon commercial. I'm fast forwarding this. And I got to the end and it said like Verizon, Exxon, Chipotle or whatever. Yep. And I'm like, wait a minute now, that wasn't a Verizon commercial.
Or like, was it?
That was absolutely a Mike Schur Year of the Whopper, Year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken, David Foster Wallace kind of shout out. And so I absolutely adored that aspect of the episode. I thought that that was brilliant. I thought that that was kind of subtle Parks and Rec at its finest. Sometimes, like the episode earlier in the series when Leslie's fighting about the size of Paunch Burgers soda cups, that's a rip from the headlines, you know, and it's a Mayor Bloomberg kind of thing. And that's all well and good, but it is social commentary. And Pawnee was always kind of about social commentary with the Nutri-Yum bars and the things that Sweetums was putting in its products and the way that those people were trying to take over kind of the concession stands at parks and things like that. But there was always that was never the point of the show, but it was always what the show did really well in a kind of a subtle, funny way. It was satire in a lot of respects. So to have this play out in Johnny Karate was great because the rest of the episode was also satire about public access television and the kind of like small time silly TV, you know, show that kids would watch and things like that. So I thought that that was all great. It's a little interesting because it came so late in the run. And yeah. I think that that's tough. But I do think that it came so late in the run because it was really important for them to say this is his last episode. And a lot of the emotion in this is going to come from April feeling really guilty about taking him away from something he really loved. And based on the way the time was kind of moving around in the course of the series, I don't know when the episode, it's not like this, they could have done this as the fourth or fifth episode of this season. So I think they wanted to do it. They realized this was the only time to do it. I think that it's hard because they were really speeding through episodes at this point. So literally this was essentially like a penultimate kind of episode because this aired a week before the finale.
Yep. It was third to last episode, I believe.
Yep, third to last episode. But I mean, but in terms of time, it was a week before the last episode, the finale. So I think that was hard. I think that was my only complaint with it is like there's this episode that takes us out of everything we know about the series or not everything we know, but the conceits we've established. It's very different in format. And it's so close to the end of this, the run. And I don't want to make a comparison to Lost season 6, but Lost has an episode like that, of course, where we go kind of into the history of a couple of the characters who haven't even really been big characters. They've kind of been talked about, but not necessarily featured. And we flash back in time, you know, several hundred, maybe thousands of years. And we go way off the final speeding of our final storylines and into this character's story. And thankfully, this didn't do that. It found a way to tie it into the what was going on with April and the storyline about everybody leaving town. And it was a really nice finale and kind of party send off for a lot of the fun aspects of the show. My only complaint would be, why the hell is there a freaking tarantula on there? I'm so scared of spiders.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had to close my eyes through most of the episode. And only after listening to it the first time, could I watch it. And when I knew where the spider was going to be.
Well, luckily you weren't Chris Jericho in that situation then.
You mean John Cena?
John Cena. Oh, I got my wrestlers mixed up.
Chris Jericho right now. I know, Mike Bloom, the check is in the mail. I know it. I know the check is in the mail. Chris Jericho's thanking you for keeping him relevant.
Yeah, I don't know why I had Chris Jericho on the brain, but I will say that in your Lost comparison,
we'll dive into that later, Mike.
Yeah. Oh boy, I need my own meeting with Dr. Richard Nygaard at this point. I will say that in your Lost comparison, I think even if Joe Garfine hadn't seen a single episode of Parks and Recreation before this, I think she would still enjoy this more than Across the Sea. So it has that going for it,
which is nice. Which is nice. And I mean, I really like seeing. Look, we see. Again, and this is if we talk about the kind of establish a theme from Parks and Recreation season 7, we've seen Andy Dwyer as a kind of boorish, horrible like boyfriend who's lying about being injured and making Ann do everything for him in season 1, evolve into kind of a, you know, know nothing, can't find his way through life, kind of silly guy in season 2. Season 3 is getting a little further into that, but that's when he marries April and he's kind of on trending upward, but he's still looking for things to do. Then we saw, you know, the stories about him going to college, wanting to be a cop, all of those storylines. So I love that at the end of the day in season 7, we finally get to see Andy Dwyer be really, really, really good at something. Mm-hmm. And have it be something that he is doing all himself. I think that that's pretty great.
Yeah. So let's we'll go back into one of our like very quick singular storylines here in John Ralphio, who we really haven't seen at all this final season. I think we saw him briefly in the second to last episode, and I'm sure that was probably a conflict schedule with Ben Schwartz and House of Lies or doing the late show. Who knows at this point? But I thought, again, it was a perfect ending to John Ralphio, both in 2017 when, you know, he was in a wheelchair using it to get to the front of the line of Six Flags, or, you know, him in 2022 trying to pull the Tom Sawyer and faking his death so he could use the insurance money to buy a restaurant in Tajikistan, I think it was.
Yeah, Tajikistan, Tajikistan, somewhere, one of the stands.
Tajikistan. But I loved, so this wasn't on, this is in the producer's cut, but there's this, you know, him and Mona Lisa are hiding behind this tree, and there's this, like, you know, he's like, all right, we gotta, you know, don't raise suspicion. And it, of course, in the true Saperstein style, it ends up, you know, talking about not drawing suspicion onto themselves, ends up like them breaking out into like a song and dance about it, which catches the entire funeral's attention, and then they take off. So I again, it spoke perfectly about the character that he would fake his own death but still be so ridiculously over the top. And I mean, Ben Schwartz just took this role and completely ran with it. It was another like little 2-minute thing, but I love seeing an ending to this character, especially since we really hadn't seen a lot of him all season.
Yeah, and I love that that for the first time ever, John Ralphio tells Leslie, "I love you," and she gives him the Han Solo.
I love. Does that mean that Leslie was gonna, shortly after the picture was taken at the very end, be frozen in carbonite?
Yeah, because they're not sure if they can get her back for Parks and Rec season 8. Yeah, they're just not sure, so they got to freeze her in carbonite and figure it out. I love Benny Schwartz, Ben Schwartz running away and saying, "Tajikistan is off, Tajikistan is off," and I know that was one of the Parks and Rec writers. I can't remember exactly which one, playing the rabbi. So that was a nice little cameo. There were a couple writer cameos in this episode, and that's a good tribute to them and the great writing staff of the show. But I really like this stuff for John Ralphio, of course. I mean, he's really funny. It's great that his singing, which is kind of his key character trait that we've grown to know and love, is what undid him for faking his death, because he's literally heard singing in the distance. It's like, of course, that's what undid him. Like, it's not like Kenny Powers or something like that, where he would have to come and make an entrance, and or it's not like Brick Tamblyn
where he's like at the funeral.
No, it's not like that. This is John Ralphio. He wants to show up and watch it like Tom Sawyer, but he cannot help himself. He's got to sing, baby. He's got to sing, and it's snowing. You know, I really liked all of that. And it's I like that this one is a kind of a deviation from form. For so many of these characters so far, we're talking about how the coda that we're seeing, or the kind of flash forward we're seeing in the finale, is more of an epilogue and kind of a cap to their character arc. John Ralphio, still up to his old tricks. Like, that's absolutely fantastic.
Yep, and apparently producing champagne. There was an Easter egg shortly released after the episode where that bottle of champagne that's being served to Typhoon and Craig way, way in the future has John Ralphio's name on it. So maybe he's escaped. Maybe he's gone to Tajikistan. Maybe he's just hiding out in some basement, but he's accrued enough cash at the moment to produce some sort of champagne.
Yeah. Hey, good for him.
Good for him. And this is a producer's cut only thing, but this is we get a little bit of Jam's epilogue as well, which was really interesting, because I thought the Ron and Jammy episode kind of showed him off. But no, it starts off, you know, in the present. I mean, 2017, of course, he has the typical, you know, Jam kind of creepiness slash endearing creepiness by, you know, his final gift to Leslie is a painting where I believe they're both naked and she's like cuddled up against him. And it turns out in Jam's epilogue, he is a hibachi chef in Daytona Beach, Florida. I can't remember. I think it was at some point in season 5 or 6 that they, you know, he talked about how much he loves hibachi restaurants or how much he wants to be a hibachi chef. So again, short, sweet, fun to watch.
And again, you point out, like, the whole Leslie touches someone's life before we see the flash forward. What she says to him is like, you know, good luck in whatever you want to do. You know, like, that's kind of what she says to him, like, have fun kind of doing whatever it is that you want to do. And then she touches him. And then the flash forward is he's working exactly where he wanted, at a Benihana or some sort of hibachi restaurant, and just living it up, flipping a shrimp into his pocket. And it's only about 10 or 15 seconds. There's also a really awkward and kind of hilarious hilarious moment where he really is feeling like that. He thinks Leslie wants to kiss him goodbye, yeah. And he's really going for the hard lean, and she is just not feeling it. And he just keeps it up, and it goes about 3 seconds longer than it needs to in order to really feel awkward. And it's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. Typical jam. Let's segue into Tom's storyline here, and we could talk about his storyline as a whole as well, because I know we talked about this a little bit offline, Antonio. I don't think either of us were the biggest fans of what happened to Tom's storyline this season in general. To bring up his future, so Tom is very successful with Tom's Bistro, and he decides to expand it into a franchise, which then goes bankrupt in amount of time that is not divulged to us. So of course it features Aziz Ansari's horrible British accent as he narrates his own documentary about his failure.
As a classic callback, I mean, he's done that multiple times. Little Sebastian, yeah. You know, he's done that multiple times throughout the series. So that's always, it's always funny. It's a nice callback. The picture on his book. We didn't get to that yet, but go ahead. Yeah.
So he ends up going on like a retreat to one of Ron's cabins. And at first he's going to write the great new action movie, which I think he calls like Sniper Race Delta, Beijing Inferno, which is an amazing name. But then Ron says, like, just write about what you know, and remember that you're going to put your name behind it in typical Ron fashion. So he says, you know, I tried to start, you know, this clothing business. I tried to start my own entertainment company. I failed. I tried to start my own clothing line. I failed. I tried to start a restaurant. I succeeded, then failed. And he realizes that failure is really the best thing that this character knows. So he pens a best-selling book called Failure, An American Success Story, which I think is just a perfect way to wrap up Tom's character, which is good because as I talked about before, I personally felt that I don't know what if the writers felt like they knew what to do with Tom this season. We got like maybe 3 episodes with him and Lucy together at the most. And then they had that wedding in that second to last episode that was like, I know it was supposed to be slapped together, but man, it was a little sloppy there. And I mean, Tom's character has seen such an interesting arc, like kind of like April, of like someone who really doesn't care to like someone who has found something to do and a purpose and something to work towards and to work for. So it was a little sad for me to be like, and then this season, Tom finds a girl again and then they get married. You know, it was reinvigorating a certain part of his character that we hadn't really seen since, his brief affair with Tatiana Maslany. But I don't know. I still don't know how to feel about it, to be honest.
Yeah, and I don't know if some of it had to do with Aziz's availability. I mean, there's always a possibility that he just wasn't available for as many episodes as some of the other actors were, because it did seem like he just wasn't around. Like, he was almost like totally absent from a lot of what was going on. And some of that was, you know, some of the episodes were in Washington. He wasn't in Washington, so he wasn't going to get focused on. But a lot of it seemed to be that he just wasn't in a lot of these episodes. And part of that is, by opening Tom's Bistro in the last kind of season, and by kind of doing what he was going to do with that, he sort of had reached a point where he had put his issues with businesses to bed. Even when he was opening his clothing store, he was still sort of taking advantage of his friends. He was still kind of feeling his way out. That was not his first venture. E720 was really kind of his first real kind of time he stuck his neck out, but he grew incrementally. And so when he got into Tom's Bistro and he was ready to make it pop, and he had some early struggles with that, but then he pulled it all together. I feel like he had kind of evolved. Like, it was like Tom was at a point where he was different than he used to be. And so I do think it's difficult for them to then go into a final season and be like, what are we going to do with Tom? And I think the answer is, well, he might have evolved restaurant wise, like that might all be well and good, and he may be successful in business finally, and he's happy about that. But he's not happy in love. Like, he doesn't have a love interest. And a good way to bring Natalie Morales back in, playing Lucy, like that all is well and good. But I think that maybe it would have made a little more sense to me to have the restaurant failure occur earlier in this season, and actually have this kind of prologue play out, or epilogue, I should say, play out over the course of the season, because I think that there's material for that there. I think there's room for that. It would have felt a little bit like similar Tom stories from before. So that would have been, I think, a little difficult, but I think that there was room to have that be his final season arc. Like, okay, the restaurant really worked and you did everything right. Cause I think what he says in this episode to Natalie Morales, after he's watched the documentary he made about his failure, is like, look, I did entertainment 720. I screwed up. Like, I did this other thing. I guess I screwed up. This time I did everything right and everything was going good and I made all the right decisions and yet I still screwed up. So it's really hard for me to accept failure at this point. And I think that that's a really kind of great place to operate from as a character if you want to kind of get into it. Like, that's a really good place to start. And I think it's pretty fertile after that. But in the finale, when we're getting there, we kind of speed that up. I don't even remember. Was the cabin scene even on the non-producer cut?
No, it just cut from Lucy talking to Tom to his presentation of the book.
Yeah. And not that the cabin scene really brings a ton to it. We do get that really funny movie title and we see that Leslie and Ben have sent him a sort of gift basket that's basically encouraging him to be a writer. And we get Ron kind of talking funny things about his cabin. It's a funny scene, but we get Tom even cut out of the finale. And so that's kind of tough because I think that's kind of acknowledging that, look, we probably could have done more. We could have done Tom having writer's block. We could have done that. And the process of Tom writing that book and his kind of realization that the best examples of successful people in his life are his friends, and that each one of them has their own strengths and weaknesses, and him kind of finding all that out. I think there's episodes in there. Like, I think that there's at least one in there, maybe more. So I do think it's a little bit of a shame that I think probably as a result of the stunted season and also probably as a result of Aziz's availability, we just didn't get that whole arc play out over the course of the season. What we got was, hey, he's going to try to work this thing out with one of his exes, the one who kind of made the most sense for him throughout the course of the series. And yeah, we're going to put that to bed by the end of the series. So I think it's a little tough. I think it's a little tough because it just kind of did feel kind of tacked on and it didn't feel like a major part of the season. But you know, I still like where that character ended up. I do think that Tom playing the sort of Jordan Belfort, like, I failed and yet I'm still going to be successful for being a failure. Donald Trump's filed for bankruptcy so many times. Like, that's Tom Haverford. Like, that is absolutely what he would do if he found himself in a failure situation. Is he's got a bunch of lemonade because somebody gave him a bunch of lemons. Like, that's absolutely what he would do. Is he's not going to stop at this point in his life. So it's good that that he's got someone in his life there to support him and kind of carry him through that, because Leslie's kind of always been sort of a key role in kind of pushing him forward, and April and Donna and others of his friends. And if they're out of the picture, it's really nice that he's got someone in his life who can give him that kind of pep talk and really be there and support him, despite the fact that he doesn't have any pocket squares anymore. I mean, what else is the eye going to be drawn to, Mike?
I know. How is he supposed to pick out which black is the best black?
That's a good question. It's hard to tell.
It's hard to tell. But much like Tom Haverford, I believe Donald Trump is once again swagalicious. So they're both on the rise in terms of swag.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point. You make a good point.
Let's move on here to newly crowned mayor Gary Gergich, which, you know, he became mayor in the second to last episode. And I feel like this last batch of episodes was like an ode to a lot of Gary moments, between the moment that we talked about at the wedding before with Donna and the moment we talked about with Donna before as well, where he lost his wedding ring and his keys down a storm drain. And he ends up becoming mayor as well as a notary, which we'll emphasize several times. But in the future, Gary is such a loved mayor by Pawnee that he is elected multiple times, at least 10 from what we can see. He produces grandchildren and great grandchildren. Candace Bergen is still the same age, which I love that. I don't know if that was like an in joke from the writers or if Candace Bergen just refused to put on old age makeup, but I still think that's really funny. And he passes away at the age of 100 happily. And as a perfect way to send off Gary Gergich, his name is spelled wrong on his tombstone.
Can you say that again, Mike?
The whole thing?
No. I got hung up on Candace Bergen.
Oh yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. No, because it's not Candace Bergen, man.
Well, who is it?
Oh, do you want to guess? Let's say we want to play a guessing game.
Yeah, give me a hint.
Model, not Murphy Brown.
I know this one and I forgot.
Do you, if you were like, let's see, I'm trying to think of a good kind of word game to play. I'm really dragging this out here, not to punish you, because I don't know people's names. I just called Tom's wife, Natalie.
Christy Brinkley.
Christy Brinkley. See the CB.
I got the CB on the brain.
I was going to say, no, I know what it is. You're still thinking about Chris Jericho.
Yeah, I think that I you know what, I think Chris is really taking my heart and mind out of this. I'm still in mourning. That's what I'm gonna credit it towards. You can give me the 21 stamp salute after this, but I apologize. It is Christy Brinkley.
You just, well, see, the thing is, Candace Bergen's agent is gonna send you a check, just like Chris Jericho's. Christy Brinkley's agent is probably trying to hunt you down right now.
So now I have both a hitman and someone chasing after me with the money. I think that's the perfect, that's the yin and the yang for you.
Yeah,
in life.
Yeah, you're gonna be perfect on House of Cards starting this weekend. Yeah, this will all work really well for you, Mike. Yeah. It's and now Dan Quayle has a beef with you for some odd reason. I don't know why. Maybe because you mentioned Candace Bergen. That's a callback. Political jokes from the 1980s. That's what we do here on Post Show Recaps. I love Gary Gergich. I love Jim O'Hare. I think he's a great guy. He seems like a great guy. Funny that he originally auditioned for the role of Ron Swanson. It's something that he did. It doesn't really seem like it would have been a good fit. But again, he walks in the room. He auditions. They like him. And they say, you know what? We like this guy. We're going to put him in the show somehow. We don't know exactly what it's going to be, but we want him on board. And the way he tells the story is that he'd seen The Office and he knew that Greg Daniels and Mike Schur had been associated with The Office. And he thought to himself, like, I saw what happened on The Office to those background characters. They became the core of the show. Like, they had their own plots and episodes. They were in the opening. Like, they became a part of the key ensemble cast. And so, of course, I'm on board. Like, I want this, even though I didn't get Ron Swanson. Like, I want to be on the show. So they famously said, and apologies if we covered this on the podcast earlier, that it took until the episode in season two where Mark Brandanowicz is there, everybody's kind of playing pranks on each other and trying to dig up dirt when they're talking about politics. And it's famous for Ron slamming the picture of Aziz, which is an actual picture of a young Aziz Ansari, and saying Taliban robes. But what Mark Brandanowicz digs up on Jerry is that, Jerry, I heard your adopted mother once did whatever. And Jerry's like, and got a horrible look on his face. And Mark's like, oh, you didn't know your mom did that? And Jerry's like, I didn't know I was adopted. And from then on, the writers of the show realized this guy's the punching bag. Like, this is the guy whose role in the show is going to be having everybody dump on him. And so that evolved into, like, okay, when we've got Jerry here and we've got this guy who just everybody takes the piss out of at work all day long, and he's so bumbling and he has fart attacks, for crying out loud, like, what is this guy's home life going to be like? And I read something this week, or maybe in the last 2 weeks in the run up to the finale, where Mike Schur said one of the pitches in the writer's room was that Jerry was going to go home and just treat his family like garbage.
Oh, that'd be so mean.
So dark, because everybody at work took it out on him. So he's going to go home and just, he treats his family like garbage.
Oh my God. That's like Pete Campbell.
Yeah, it is like Pete Campbell, right? Yeah. He's like living out in West Egg or somewhere out in Long Island. No, yeah. It's a dark version. The darkest timeline of Parks and Recreation has a Jerry, Gary Gergich, who goes home and beats his wife and drinks himself into a stupor every night. But the reality is they went with the exact opposite of that, right? Like, the guy's got the perfect home life, gorgeous wife, married to Candace Bergen, couldn't be better. Sorry. And gorgeous daughters. And just he goes on vacations to the bustling town of Muncie, Indiana. And he loves timeshares and silly stuff, and couldn't be happier. And so it is absolutely a wonderful send-off for this character within the course of this final season that he got to be mayor at all. And just a ridiculous kind of they had a marching band there and they had a hot air balloon and all the stuff that was there. Just fantastic way to say, in a meta way, like, hey, let's make up to you for all the abuse that we've given you. Giving you a hot wife who played Murphy Brown was not enough. We are now going to take this and put you in a freaking hot air balloon and make you mayor. And that was awesome. But then to take it a step further and make him what he always wanted to be, which is essentially like just so happy by being the lifetime mayor and the new Mayor Gunderson. And the way I think that there were subtle in-jokes within the context of that kind of through the years of Mayor Gary Gergich, showing Brandy Max as president of the city council.
Yeah.
Yeah, because she always wanted to kind of ride Leslie Knope's coattails, and here she is on city council doing way better on city council than Leslie ever did.
Star of 11,000 adult films in 2 years.
In 2 years. Well, I don't want to think about that. I really, like, that boggles the mind, and I worry about Brandy Max, Mike. I really do.
Well, I heard she was in a good one with Candace Bergen, I heard.
She's just, maybe there's a lot where she just gets in a relationship with somebody who's there to paint her house. I don't know. I'm making Murphy Brown jokes now, Mike. That's where we're at with this. So anyway, what I really liked about that, though, is a couple Easter eggs in that scene. One was one of the writers, Joe Mandy, plays the next kind of president of the Pawnee Council, the guy with the kind of balding hair who's swearing Gary in the very kind of distant future, where I think one of the council is dressed in sort of, did I see some Star Wars or Tatooine robes up there? Or
something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and there was video running behind the city council desk, and it said something about Alien Gate and how Patriots coach Bill Belichick swears that none of his players are aliens.
Oh my god.
Yeah, and I was like, this is just, I mean, Parks and Rec is knocking it out of the park here. Like, this is they're little subtle little background things going on. They're societal commentary, they're funny jokes about the future, they're cameos from the writers, there's cameos from past characters, there's great character service for Gary Gergich. And then to have him die on his 100th birthday with Claudia Schiffer. Her name's Claudia Schiffer, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
With Claudia Schiffer not having aged a day, which is hilarious. And the 21 stamp salute. It's perfect. And I mean, it's just a wonderful kind of Mr. Gergich goes to Pawnee sort of story about how he put up with a lot and he was able to effectuate some change in his life for the better, even though he was very happy outside of it. So I was very happy for Gary and couldn't have been happier for Jim O'Hare.
Can we just touch for a brief second on how they were able to land freaking Bill Murray as the mayor? I know it's their big white whale that they've been hunting for 7 seasons, but I am thrilled beyond belief that they were able to do it and that they were able to, you know, I think that I read that when they initially pitched him the episode, they said he just needs to like lie in the coffin, but I'm glad they were able to catch him on video. And I believe the lines that they ended up using for him were actually an improv. So, you know, Bill Murray is a character to begin with, but I'm thrilled that he was able to come on and work on the show in this capacity.
Yeah, and Bill Murray legendarily is really tough to corral. Like, if you want Bill Murray to appear in your project, you're supposed to call this random phone number for one of his attorneys and leave a message, and maybe you'll hear back from him, maybe you won't. And he's sort of America's house guest. He's just kind of all over the world, and he'll pop up in Charleston, South Carolina one week and in Finland the next, and crash a party in Brooklyn one week and then be in Palm Springs playing golf the next. You just never know where Bill Murray is going to turn up. So I do think that they had tried and failed, and then apparently Aubrey Plaza had kind of been running in some circles that put her in contact with Bill Murray. I think that everybody had kind of put some pressure on him. I think Retta had put some pressure on him some way, and I think Amy Poehler had. So I think that they, and I was Rashida Jones part of that as well?
I believe so. I think it was like the triumvirate of Amy, Aubrey, and Rashida that helped put the pressure on Bill.
And then they were just doing it in different ways. Some of them had been involved in things that he was working on or shown up at a lot of the same parties or whatever, but they were really kind of full court pressing him. And then I think he called up Mike Schur and he said, I heard you have some dead work for me. It's like, so they brought Bill Murray on set. They didn't build a mannequin of Bill Murray. They brought him on set to lie in a coffin, and they shot that cameo in a number of different ways so that if they weren't going to get Bill Murray, because it was one of those things like this could fall through.
Yeah.
So they were just covering the casket up with a pick, with a sign, or, you know, with something so that it wasn't clear who was in the casket just in case it didn't work out and they needed coverage. But then Bill Murray shows up on set. Like you said, they wrote about 20 different sides for him for his different versions of his sort of farewell speech. And then it ended up being the one they used was, of course, he did every single one of the ones they wrote for him. And then he did kind of one or two of his own, and the one or two of his own that he improvised ended up being in the show. So fantastic. If I had a question for Mike Schur or the producers or writers of Parks and Rec, it would be, you got Bill Murray. Like, any other regrets? Like, who else did you miss out on? You got Michelle Obama. You got Joe Biden. The show is, you got J.K. Simmons. Like, so many, you got the guy who plays Mike Ehrmantraut on Breaking Bad, Jonathan Banks. Like, you have so many great guest stars throughout the course of this series. And really, it's a who's who. If you're going to look at the series in 15 or 20 years, there's just people just populating this town and this universe of characters. I want to know, Mike, sure, if you're listening, What's your white whale now? What do you regret that? Who do you regret that you didn't get on the show? You can tweet at me. My handle is A Mike Bloom type.
I think it's going to be Kim Jong Un. I'm going to answer it for him.
Oh, well, he was busy doing the interview, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or they probably have Amy Poehler do. Amy Poehler did a good Kim Jong Il on SNL, so maybe she could have just had her do that. This is again another coming up as another producer cut only epilogue. This is from Shauna, and this is by far my favorite Shauna guy situation, which is, you know, we talk about heightening in terms of comedy. This is the most heightened Shauna situation I've ever heard, which is that she was dating a guy that she really liked, but it turned out to be a computer program created by a scientist to test the gullibility of human women. It's just like that. That's an amazing line, an amazing concept for me. But she has a much happier future. She is left at the altar by a guy whose game went into overtime, and we'll leave it as vague as that. But she's able to find Bobby Newport, who I guess was just sort of hanging around after his cameo in the last episode where he, you know, he didn't want to be mayor, and a pack of gum was all it needed. And 5 hours later, they were married, and we could only assume that they led happy lives together.
I mean, are there really other shows on television that could have a Paul Rudd cameo that they cut out?
Yeah, that's like prime material on like any other primetime show. Parks and Rec is the only show that had to cut a Paul Rudd cameo in its series finale.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure Paul Rudd was probably OK with that. He seems like a good enough guy. But yeah, it's funny for it. It's really just there for pure comedy. And it's sort of a nice cap for Bobby Newport as well as Shauna Mulway Tweep. Shauna Mulway Tweep, not always the most. It's not like she was. I don't think she was on the series as much as, say, a Pert Hapley or Joan Calamezzo. But she was a recurring character on the series. So it was kind of a funny character note that she, of all people, that's what happens with Bobby Newport, is he gets married to unlucky in love Shauna Mulway Tweep. It's really funny.
Yeah. And I loved that, you know, they did a callback to Leslie's headline with Shauna and the, you know, her ridiculous headlines, and this one was not only too long, but it was also very very, very sexually explicit, so I'm happy that that again, you talked about the callbacks that they make through the rest of the series and kind of completing the circle a bit with some of these characters. I liked diving a bit into Shauna in that 1 second, but let's move on to Ron's, because Ron's is a big story, and it touches on some stuff that talks about Leslie and Ron, and again, it completes the circle really well, especially considering Ron when we first met him. So Ron, despite owning his own, you know, building company and it being very profitable, he decides he doesn't want it. So he leaves it to his brothers, Don and Vaughn Swanson, who I absolutely loved. I loved Don Swanson's beard. Antonio, were you jealous of Don Swanson's beard?
No, I don't usually have beard envy. But I was proud of it. I was very, I recognized its splendor and power. And I was very, very impressed.
Takes a beard to know a beard.
It does. And you are what you eat.
All right, I'll leave it at that. So Ron goes, he ends up kind of in a crisis of faith again, where he goes to Leslie and Ben in Washington, and he kind of says, like, I just like before, you know, with the Parks Department, I really did not enjoy the office work. And, you know, I hate to say this, but this time I really kind of do want a job in the federal government. Can you help me out? And this is, you know, it was sort of like a what if scenario of if Leslie hadn't missed that lunch in that one episode, the one lunch that's talked about in Leslie and Ron, and Leslie is able to give him his Valhalla. Basically, she basically says you're in charge of Pawnee National Park. So Ron, even though he's basically a big park ranger and he's working for the government, he has a huge expanse of land to take care of. And I mean, the unmitigated glee on Nick Offerman's face as he paddled that canoe is a fantastic image, not only for the character, but just for the series, in terms of like Ron is at peace. He's working in an establishment that he's always hated, but he is so at peace, and he owns 51% of a whiskey distillery. So Ron Swanson is perfect.
Yeah. And really, I mean, what you say earlier about Leslie Knope literally and metaphorically touching people's lives that she's contacted. I mean, nowhere I think is this more prevalent than with Ron. Ron was an anti-government libertarian, kind of live in a cabin, live off the grid, don't talk to anybody. I mean, he's still, even in the beginning of this season and kind of throughout, calling people workplace proximity acquaintances. He is not a guy with any friends and doesn't want to admit it. And we've seen her draw some of that out of him. We've seen her help him get through Ron and Tammy and really get past Tammy too. We've seen her try to enter a frontier drinking contest and help him get past Tammy one. And we've seen her sort of just really bring Ron the things that make Ron Ron without really taking that away from him at times. Although I thought there were several great callbacks. One of the kind of episodes that I struggle with as a huge Parks and Recreation fan is an episode, and this is pretty common with Leslie Knope. She will kind of roll people over and just steamroll people, and sometimes in an obnoxious way. And near the beginning of season four, there's the Pawnee Rangers episode where mm-hmm. Ron has set up this Boy Scout or Girl Scout like group of young kids who want to live in the great outdoors. And of course he's giving them the sort of horrible treatment that is with that. And it's for all boys. It's not for boys and girls at the time. And so Leslie's like response is, I'm going to set up a girls group, but I'm going to make the group so fun. I'm not just going to give my kids a tarp and say, build your shelter. I'm going to actually let them do fun things and bake things and have projects and, you know, play with remote control boats and cars and airplanes and do all sorts of crazy stuff. And she really takes something Ron wanted and liked away from Ron. And she goes kind of steamrolls over him. And it's really kind of cruel and very thoughtless. It's very anti-Knope in some ways. It's one of those episodes that shows what the weaknesses of her character can do to the strengths of her character when they're unmitigated. And it's great because Ron's group was called the Pawnee Rangers, of course. And by the end of this sort of little arc in this episode, she's given Ron a whole new group of Pawnee Rangers. And he's now the boss of a whole different group of adult rangers. And I even thought to myself, I wonder if any of those park rangers were some of the kids that were featured in those episodes that took place in, you know, 10, 15 years before that. And I don't know if there were or they weren't. But because I thought at that point it might have been, there should have been like a shot of recognition or something like that. But I mean, I think that the link was really clear and it was a nice kind of callback to that moment where Ron is addressing his group of rangers. But this time he's addressing them as their boss. And at the end of that episode, she did sort of redeem herself earlier. She gave him the new group called Swansons and she put an ad in the paper and a bunch of boys and girls showed up who wanted to really live the hard, rough life outdoors and dig ditches and do, you know, the kind of stuff that Ron Swanson would admire. So it's not like she was unredeemed then, but I think this is a really nice way to bring some of that stuff back full circle. Again, you mentioned the Lagavulin whiskey distillery. That's another callback to when Leslie kind of, when they went to Europe and sent Ron on this sort of scavenger hunt. And that was kind of a way to treat him and give him something that he really wanted, but let him be by himself and doing it and show him a way to really like Europe or things about it. And so that was a really nice callback that Ben told him to diversify his investments. And he bought 51% of the distillery, his whiskey distillery that he's always loved. So that was great, but you're right. Nothing can beat the Willie Nelson Buddy song playing, Ron's song that he picked that we featured in Leslie and Ron. And while he's canoeing across the just beautiful, they had a beautiful day to shoot that on. Oh. It was unbelievable. In a canoe called The Lucky Boy. Like this is so perfect. This is so perfect. If the episode had ended right there, I mean, I would have been sobbing because I already was. But I would have felt like, oh, my God, this is the best way to end this. Of course, it didn't need to end that way. But I mean, it was almost like Leslie and Ron is so central to the show, more so even than Leslie and Ben, that it was such a great, great moment. And it was that wasn't the end of the episode. So it's like, wow, like what else can this episode bring us? Great story. Like this to me was like the perfect way to kind of bring this all full circle. And again, as you pointed out, I loved how it was sort of a mini arc of everything we had kind of seen play out in Leslie and Ron, where we saw Ron struggling with something. This time it was something that he was perfectly happy with, which was the very good building company, and kind of resigning himself to asking Leslie for advice prostrating himself, getting to a point where Leslie could give him some advice and really getting the benefit of that. This is what happens if you're Leslie Knope's friend and you ask her for advice. And a really kind of a great capper to that is when Ron's giving his speech to the Rangers. He's like, we'll talk, but not really too much. And then he says something like, I already have enough friends. And he uses the word friends. And it's like, damn, Ron, like you've really like you. Leslie has helped you grow. And then they kind of pull back after that great canoe scene to showing him on those swings with Leslie holding her hand. And it's like, oh, man, I was gutted.
I agree that like this show on the whole seems more about Leslie and Ron than it does about Leslie and Ben, just because the two represent such diametrically opposed forces of like, you know, the proto government type and the one that completely believes like the government should not be in their lives whatsoever. And a lot of the storylines are about the two of them in conflict. You know, Ben became a quick supporter of Leslie soon after they really started to get together. The Ron Leslie friendship is something that has been so interestingly touched upon throughout these seven seasons. So I'm glad we got our glimpse of it. I'm glad Ron was the last supporting character aside from Ben to get an epilogue, because he really has become one of the most important characters from the show. And Nick Offerman has had a justifiably great breakout role from this. I don't know what award season is going to bring at this point, because, you know, the show is finishing up in February. It's been four seasons since Parks has been nominated for best comedy. It'd be great if it was nominated, but I don't even know if it would win. But I would love to see a supporting actor nomination for Nick Offerman at this point.
Yeah, and I have a feeling he's just going to continue to be criminally underrecognized for his work on the show. And I understand some aspects of that. It's just he's not. Chris Pratt might get a nomination before him because Chris Pratt is now a name, and a lot of that has to do with the Emmys. I mean, Steve Carell never won an Emmy for playing Michael Scott.
Yep.
And Amy Poehler's never won an Emmy for playing Leslie Knope, right?
Nope. She's won a Golden Globe, but not an Emmy.
So some of that is just pure politics. And it's about like the fact that a lot more people watch Modern Family than watch Parks and Rec. And maybe that's not fair. Maybe that's terrible, but it is what it is. And so I don't think we'll ever see that. But you know what? He's already won every Emmy my heart has to give. So let it flow, baby. Like, let that happen. When I do my heart's Emmy awards later this year, he'll definitely get one.
All right. So stay tuned in July, folks, for Antonio's Heart Emmy Awards. We'll do a roundtable for it.
Yeah, I'm moving him out of July this year, Mike. It's too hot in the summer.
All right. Well, we'll time to date TBD then.
TBD because July just isn't right.
So you talk about the politics of Emmys. Let's keep on that politics train and let's dive into Leslie and Ben's story. And we can kind of segue this into what culminates in the last, I'd say, like 15 minutes of the episode, which kind of hangs out in this indeterminate period of time after 2017, where we get the not so surprising return of Anne and Chris. But this is this again is like a little mini arc in itself of Ben has obviously won his Congress spot. I know some people may have complained that they, you know, we didn't really see any of it. We had like the primary episode, which by the way was so fantastic. I loved all the whole like gender and politics stuff. It skewers and mocks and puts in the spotlight and everything. But we already saw a political campaign with Leslie that took an entire season. I feel like we didn't need to necessarily see it happen all over again on the Congress scale with Ben. But Ben is a congressman, and the next step apparently for both Leslie and Ben apparently is governor of Indiana. And you know, they very quickly find out that each one of them is kind of been backed to be the nominee, and they have to decide who's going to do it. But they decide to you know, hash it out when they go visit Pawnee. Now, Antonio, while this was going on, did you think at all that Ben was really going to be running for governor of Pawnee?
I mean, Ben Wyatt is from Minneapolis or from Minnesota, so having him be governor of Indiana just didn't really fit. So not totally. On the other hand, I do think that it would have been really wrong of him to take that opportunity from Leslie. I think, and he's already a congressman, so he's got other opportunities. And maybe if this is something that she wrote in her 5-year-old dream journal, then there's no way to take that from her. So no, I didn't think that, but I thought there was a possibility Leslie might bail out or get another offer or be in a position where Ben did do that. But I didn't think he was going to take it from her. No chance.
Absolutely. Again, as you said, when the very first thing that Leslie says out of her mouth after the DNC woman says, like, how would you feel about governor? And she says, like, oh, you've been reading my kindergarten dream journal. It's like the very first, you know, scene we get of Leslie Knope in Parks and Rec is her with pictures of Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi and her being like, you know, my journey is going to be wild. So buckle up, that type of thing. Like, I think this is the perfect place for Leslie to end. But, you know, before that, I think we get a little bit of distraction in the comeback to Pawnee. And of course, everybody's there and Ed and Chris are there. And it was really nice to see them. I enjoy the work that Rashida Jones and Chris Traeger both bring to it. I'll be honest and say that I won't say I'm happy that they were gone, but I thought it was nice. I think it put a lot less burden on the writers to find something for every single ensemble member to do every episode because there were two less to write for. I was thrilled to see that, like, great, they were happy in Michigan, in Ann Arbor. They had their kids, and now they're moving back. That's fantastic. I thought it was a nice little check-in for two characters that I enjoyed.
Yeah, and we didn't need a flash forward for them. We didn't need as you know, the coverage that other characters got, even though I think that we can appreciate that. There were some great character notes. I like that Leslie and Anne want their son and daughter to fall in love. That's really funny to me. And I, of course, that's exactly what Leslie Knope's doing. And I like that Chris Traeger has got some sort of futuristic. He's got wearable technology that he's using to kind of rate his health. And Leslie says cancer, and Rob Lowe gives a great delivery. Like, she says, aren't you worried about cancer? And he says, well, now I am. Like, it's just really, I mean, it's really great. Like, total great Chris Traeger stuff. And we got some more and Leslie kind of just kind of coda. So that's great. I mean, I like that it's that we got them back. I'm glad that we had the cameo, and I think that was the right place to have it and do it rather than have it be the kind of focus of the final episode in one way, shape or form. Like, I like that it was at the end of that. I really like this. I mean, this episode is so brilliantly written, not just from the concept or not just from the way that they tie in so much that was referenced in earlier Parks and Recreation, but also the structure. So, I mean, this is an episode where they're on their last day in Pawnee. They're going to do one last project and then they're going to leave town. And that is like one timeline. And then we're advancing through other timelines in the future, some of which intersect, some of which don't, some of which they build from, some of which they never get to. But we ultimately end up with a present timeline that we get with Leslie and Ben, where we flash forward enough that we're seeing Leslie and Ben's life. And then we take that flash forward timeline and we bring all the other characters into it. I just think it's really structured in a brilliant way. And there aren't too many sitcoms that ever reach this level of writing structure ever, period, let alone ones that do it so seamlessly that it's just perfect. And Parks and Recreation can't get enough credit for the way this all played out. So I really like that that's where Ann and Chris come in. It's several years after the swing was fixed that we saw the first half of the episode. Maybe it's some years before some of the events that we see in flash forward later, mm-hmm. like at Jerry's funeral. Or we can talk about that. Or at the Indiana University speech. Like, it's we've advanced beyond the events of where the show ends by the time the show does end. So we've seen glimpses even beyond that. So they freaking wrote an epilogue to their epilogue. It's unbelievable. Like, it's just I think it's going to be hard to look back at series finales of sitcoms and say there are any that really executed this degree of difficulty so well.
Yeah.
So bringing Ann and Chris in here in this moment of that timeline was really, I think, the best time to do it. And I think that I also want to say, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, because you brought up and raised a great point about how up until this point, what we've seen is how Leslie has touched all of these characters. And we've seen how Leslie touching their lives has helped them. And we see that in a way that touches on all of the past through the characters, all of the things that they've been through and the places that they're at now, and advances it beyond that. And so that Leslie's role throughout their life is clear. And then the other thing about this is, though, and what you were saying just a few minutes ago, where we first met Leslie Knope and she said, hang on, because my ride's going to be a bumpy one or whatever. when we first met Leslie Knope, like, she was kind of terrible. I mean, there's no two ways about it. She was clueless. She thought she was much stronger than she was. She wasn't the uber, like, superwoman that she was. April and Tom were openly mocking her. And I think the show really struggled with this version of Leslie Knope in season one. And a big part of why it started working a lot better is the surrounding and supporting characters started having a lot more respect for her, so that the audience, we could say, oh, we're supposed to respect this woman, not think she's ridiculous. And then once we took that kind of stance, I think it worked out a lot better. But I think that another way of saying that is, like, sure, all those characters' lives, they never could have gotten to the point they got without her. But I don't think she could have ever gotten to the point that she got without all of those other characters.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And so I think that that's a really wonderful way to tie April and Anne and Andy and Chris and Ben and Gary and Retta, Donna, and everybody back into this final scene. Is like, Leslie's about to run for governor. This is where she announced her campaign for city council. This is where she announced that she was going to stick with her campaign and Ben was going to be her campaign manager. It's great callbacks to all the times the team has supported her in the past and how Leslie Knope is Leslie Knope because of all these people. And yeah, they're all who they are because of Leslie, but it's a two-way street. And I think that that is really what Parks and Rec is all about, is that team metaphor that Leslie talks about. And I think that this final kind of series of scenes here that hammer that home are incredible.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I totally think that I agree that the influence that Leslie has on her co-patriots are twofold. I think I do not think she would be as energetic and as into everything around her if it wasn't for the people, especially because she believes so much in someone like Tom or someone like April. You know, April, she had pegged for a long time to, like, be in her position. And granted, that was incorrect. But, like, the fact that, like, April was this girl for a while, had no volition to do anything whatsoever. But Leslie saw so much potential on her, and that definitely had an effect on her. Like, it works so much. It works, like, you know, so recursively. I would almost compare it to, like, Leslie and Leslie's coworkers are like her horcruxes almost, in that she's instilled part of her personality into them. But as a result, like, they kind of represent her as a culmination. You know, if you mess with one of her horcruxes, she'll be a little weakened as a result. That's part of her soul. I don't want to compare Leslie Knope to Voldemort too much, but I'll say
she who must not be named.
Yeah, but I love that so much. And I'll touch on a couple points that you were just talking about. I loved, you know, we're talking about structure. I love the idea that the 2017 storyline was just fixing a swing. I think it goes back to Parks and Recreation's roots of how mundanely bureaucratic it is, that despite the things about, like, time capsules and, you know, huge sodas and all these wacky things that are going on with the miniature horses and giant harvest festivals, that, like, at the end of the day, its roots are still grounded in, like, this is a Parks and Recreation Foundation. Someone's going to come up and be like, hey, can someone get this tire out of my yard? And that's what they're going to spend the whole day around. So I love that the 2017 storyline was so simple but so true to the idea of a Parks and Recreation department that the show is about. But you brought up a good question. Let's do some speculation here. Leslie and Ben at Gary's funeral had a rather sturdy set of what appeared to be Secret Service men behind them. Now, should we make the assumption and assume that one of them is president or some sort of high position or was president?
I think so. Mike Schur has said that this is their David Chase ends Sopranos moment, where he said all the evidence that you need to determine who or what happened is right there in the show. It's all in the show. So if you take it at that level, there's a couple of things that go on. First and foremost, Leslie's giving that speech at what I assume is a Pawnee kind of satellite campus of IU. Mm-hmm. And she says, I've been two terms as your governor, and I'm not even sure I'm prepared for what's next. It's going to be really exciting or whatever. So she's sort of teasing at the edges or hinting at that she's maybe about to take on some greater thing that happens. So there's that happens. There's also the fact that the Secret Service, you know, you can decide for yourself which one of the two of them they first speak to when they say at the funeral, like, it's time for us to go. But they're very clearly the Secret Service in that regard.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to think, honestly, that both of them have been president. That's what I like to think.
Like a Bill and possibly Hillary type of thing.
Yeah, well, let's fast forward to 2017, see what happens.
Yeah, I mean,
but yeah, I like to think that, that is what it is. I like to think that they've both been president.
I like that idea as well, though. Do Secret Service men still follow former presidents around?
Yep.
Oh, they do.
Yep.
I did not know this.
Yep.
I guess I was too busy writing Chris Jericho and Candice Bergen fan fiction to notice what's been going on around.
Please tell me that slash fic.
Oh yeah. Oh, obviously. Jergen, is that their portmanteau?
Jergens is a hand lotion, Mike, and I don't think we need to get into that.
Oh boy. Yeah. That's one leads to the other. Yeah, let's touch a little bit on this ending now, because I mean, how the guttingly sweet to just, you know, Leslie's speech at Indiana State University, about, she goes back to this whole analogy that she talks about with April about how important being on a team is. And, you know, she talks about what we just talked about, how about, like, you know, she wouldn't be where she is without her team. And it's one of those meta moments where you feel like it's not just Leslie Knope talking about the park staff, it's Amy Poehler talking about the entire team of the show. And it's so beautiful. And then segue into, you know, the 2017, the swing's fixed. They get a picture of themselves, and we get some moments here and there. You know, we get Andy's new character, Sergeant Thunderfist, MD, whose prop is a stethoscope that's found in the sandbox. And you just get these really simple words from Leslie that she says, "I'm ready." And, you know, this is making me even oddly emotional talking about it, just because of, you know, the finality of it all and the surety and very downplayed nature of the way Amy Poehler delivers it is, and her looking like straight into the camera with this confident grin on her face was so representative of this show as a whole and the characterization of this person. And I think it was a pitch perfect way to end the show.
Yeah, she's often copped the catchphrase from Friday Night Lights, "Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose." And there's no doubt in that moment she was absolutely channeling clear eyes and full hearts and looking forward and saying, you know, with head held high, "I'm ready." And she's ready because she has her team. She has her people around her. She knows her spot in the world. She's totally confident in everything that she needs to do. And as Mike Schur said, all the evidence is in the show. I mean, this is a great piece of evidence that it's probably Leslie, at least to begin with, that runs for president and is elected. She's ready for whatever faces her next. And I think Parks and Rec has always been a show that's so full of hope and so full of like this erstwhile earnestness that it really kind of pulls off in so many respects that its lasting takeaway is that, you know, with your people around you and with your team and with the people that you need in your life and knowing your position in that, you're really ready for whatever comes next, whether it's a silly picture or whether it's running for president. Like, yeah. If you get yourself to that position and you're that confident and comfortable and clear and happy, you can take whatever life throws at you. And I don't know, man, that is like it is aspirational type stuff. It's like public speaking type stuff. But on the other hand, like it is absolutely so perfectly consistent with the general themes and ethos of the show that it couldn't really be better. I used to think for a long time that the great last shot of the show would be in some ways a tribute to Cheers, with them kind of leaving the park's office and turning the lights out and kind of setting the set apart. And that's fine. But then The Office is kind of, you know, doing a very similar thing there. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's not something that would have been, it's kind of tread before. And so I think this, let's get our ensemble together, surround ourselves with the people we love and take a picture while we're saying, "I'm ready." I think it's just great. I mean, it's just great. It doesn't have to be, it's not clever. It doesn't have to be clever. It doesn't have to be hilarious. For Parks and Rec, it's just, it's emotional and it's ultimately uplifting. And that, I think, is really the legacy of this show. That for a sitcom, I mean, I love 30 Rock, but 30 Rock is goofy. 30 Rock is like what Family Guy, which I can't stand, should be, which is like asides and funny side jokes. And, you know, let's pan the camera around and let's flash back to the time that this happened and show it and be funny about that. And 30 Rock is all of those things. And it's also sweet in some ways. And there's a lot going on, but it doesn't have this over. It's more clever. Not that Parks and Rec isn't, but it's more clever. And Parks and Rec is more in tune, certainly, with The Office, in that there was a lot more heart and emotion in it at its center. And a lot of that really does definitely owe to Amy Poehler and the way she played this role. And it is absolutely a travesty that she hasn't won an Emmy for it. And maybe she'll get some recognition this year. I'm not holding my breath, and I hope that she doesn't feel like she needs it, because, I mean, I think that it's well-deserved and earned at this point.
Yeah, I completely agree with all those sentiments. I don't want to eulogize the show too much. This will probably do like a little wrap up at the end about the series as a whole. But I mean, this was a fantastic way to end, and especially the idea that we just talked about Leslie's maturation. The fact that, you know, this is a girl who grew up in Pawnee her entire life, was like, you know, rah, 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 obsessed with her hometown. And now she is leaving to take a job in Washington, and she, you know, one of the reasons why she like didn't want to get booted from city council is because she's like, oh, this town is going to go to crap if I'm not in charge of it and I'm not making sure that everything's okay. But I think she's gradually learned that like everything, it'll be okay. And I think she's learned to trust not only her friends but her town to make things right the Pawnee way, which is such a cool idea. I feel like we would be remiss to not briefly discuss the unfortunate passing of Harris Whittles. This was brought up in a slate at the very, very end of the show after a great little, you know, little gag set to over the end credits. But for those of you that might not be akin to it, Harris was an executive producer on Parks and Recreation. He wrote a good handful of great episodes, and he also played one of the animal control guys who was also named Harris. And he unfortunately passed away of a drug overdose at the age of 30, I believe, this past week. And you know, it hit the Parks cast pretty hard, specifically Amy Poehler and Aziz Ansari. And I think, you know, this show is a great representation of his work, which is that, like, you know, if you didn't know Harris's work too well, it was goofy and it was insane and it was a little brash, but you know what, it did have emotion behind it, and you could really see the heart in that comedian. So I think this episode ends up being, I don't know how much Harris was involved in it, but it ends up being kind of a perfect tribute to who he was as a comedian.
Yeah, I thought about him a lot the second time I watched it, when the real, like, the team metaphor really stood out, and when it was about kind of how you can be seen as superhuman and you can see yourself as special and you can do great things, but you really are not going to rise to the heights that you can rise to without great people around you, each of whom has their own specific humanity and strengths and weaknesses and brings so many different things to the table. And I got to feel like if you wanted to read into it from a meta level, if Mike Schur is Leslie Knope, or even Amy Poehler being a producer of the show and writer and sometimes director as Leslie Knope, she's nobody. And this show is nothing. If the show is Leslie Knope, it's nothing without the writers that were part of that team, and that brought their own specific humanity to it. Each brought their own kind of special things to the show. And I think all of them, whether it's someone like Norm Hiscock or Alan Yang, Katie Dippold, I think Megan Anram has written a bunch of Parks and Rec. I know she does. Chelsea Peretti has written on Parks and Rec, like just Dan Gore, who now runs Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And I mean, it's not getting into a name check thing here. Mike Scully, obviously, but I think any of them, they all bring special things to the table. But I feel like, and I get the sense that Harris Whittles was very different. He also was heavily involved with Eastbound and Down, mm-hmm. which is a show I really like. And being involved in Eastbound and Down and Parks and Rec is sort of like, to me, then you've got a really great pedigree there, because Eastbound and Down is, if you take Parks and Recreation and you make it totally profane and you make it totally offensive and almost abrasively so, but yet find a way to work hard into it, then that's what Eastbound and Down is. And to know that he was involved in both of those things, as well as a frequent guest on the podcast Comedy Bang Bang, yep. and always being really, really funny in his recurring segments or podcasts there. He's the inventor of Humble Brag. I'd like to say, you know, I met Harris Whittles and I'm really sorry that he died, but I can't say that, but that would be a decent humble brag. He was a creator of it. He recognized something that occurred in our cultural zeitgeist, mostly with celebrities, where people were boasting about things, but then downplaying it. But it was a way to get away with the boast. Like he started the Twitter feed, would just retweet random examples of it. just from celebrities on down to people who were their Twitter avatar was an egg and they had very few Twitter followers. Like Harris was calling out humble braggers across the spectrum. And to know that he struggled with addiction, and he was very open about it. He did a great podcast with Pete Holmes.
Yep, You Made It Weird.
You Made It Weird, where he talked about it. It's horrible to listen to now, but it had just recently come out. And it's a really just a really tough loss in any respect. To have it occur at this time, it's just got to be so brutal for everybody that was involved in the show that I hope you, if you're listening to this, love so much. That I mean, it's impossible to watch this finale and not feel so many feels and twinges of that as a result of that happening. So it's just my heart goes out to everybody involved with this show and everybody who had any kind of interaction with Harris and feels like they lost someone there, because it's very clear that you did. And I don't think that there's anything that you or I could say, Mike, that would really encapsulate exactly what they lost truly. But it's very clear that Harris had a major impact on Parks and Recreation, a major, major impact. I mean, you can go to the Wikipedia page for Parks and Rec and look at some of the episodes that he wrote. I guarantee you're going to remember a lot of them. I guarantee you you're going to remember some specific scenes from them. And you again can see him. He appeared on this season of Parks and Rec. He showed up in the basement there. Putting a freaking vice to his head just because he's being silly, and he definitely was not living in the basement. So it's just a real kind of the finale of the show is already going to be super bittersweet. Yeah. But to have this happen makes it makes it about something entirely different. And I just don't know how any of these people are soldiering on through it. But my heart definitely goes out to them.
Absolutely. Speaking just briefly about the gag reel, I do love that the very apparent very last shot of Parks and Recreation involved Gary being in a giant coffee outfit.
Yeah. And that's it's one of those things where you can throw kind of this bittersweet melancholy into it at the end. But at the end of the day, you've got Jim O'Hare dressed in as a giant coffee machine for a musical number that he and Leslie allegedly wrote. He and Gary and Leslie allegedly wrote to try to convince the office that they needed to not switch to a single cup coffee maker, that they needed to keep the original coffee.
Yeah, and machine. Apparently the vote was 4-3. So yes. I don't know what sort of hung jury was going on in the Parks Department that day, but it seems like some riveting drama.
Yeah. And again, I just love that that's an episode of Parks and Recreation we didn't see. But in our minds, we love the show, and the show's so well written and conceived that I think we can imagine exactly how that would play out and who would take what side and why and where that would all go down and what the B story would be. This show its universe was so perfectly conceived and it was so expansive, even though it was perfectly conceived, that we can imagine exactly where that plot would go and why it would happen. And it fits perfectly in. We don't need to see it to know that I'm sure that happened. Like, oh, yeah. I'm sure that happened. It's not a callback to anything. It's a callback to something that didn't happen on screen for us, but clearly we can imagine happening and fitting right into everything else that those goofballs were ever up to. And maybe finally one day they'll be watching the show in Middle Korea.
Yeah.
I didn't understand like why Donna and Joe went to Middle Korea. Again, it's just Parks and Rec. Parks and Rec can create a universe where a few years in the future, we don't just have North and South Korea anymore. Now we have a Middle Korea and it fits seamlessly in there. So it's a show that can give us Middle Korea and the kind of social commentary that comes with that, or it can give us Jim O'Hare dancing as a coffee, like a giraffe or whatever. And it's on the same episode and both of them are funny. So yeah. That's Parks and Rec. I mean, it's just it's tough. And it reminds me of Ben Wyatt saw Leslie Knope in flu season for the first time as Leslie Knope and said, that's Leslie Knope. Like, that's Parks and Rec. That's what this show is.
Absolutely. And I do love the fact that there are like specifically in this last season, there were several what Calvin and Hobbes refers to as like noodle incidents of like things that everyone, all the characters know about happen off screen, but they have associate a certain emotion with it. Those are always fun moments. But let's you already started to wrap it up, but let's see if we can close this large book on this season. Now, I know Alan Sepinwall wrote a series of fantastic articles about this show. And one of them he wrote about what sort of significance is Parks and Recreation going to have in the world of comedy, in the world of sitcoms going forward. And it's going to be tough to peg down, but I'm going to put the pressure on you a little bit, Antonio. Try to answer that for me. What sort of impression will Parks and Recreation leave on the television comedy as it is right now?
Well, it is a little tough to pin down, but what I'll say is this. I think first and foremost, the milieu of Parks and Rec was a parks department, and that it was a small set. And that was when you make TV, you have to, you're not going to be able to just get every single set that you want or shoot everywhere that you want. You have to have some kind of home base. For Cheers, it was a bar. For The Office, it was The Office. And for Parks and Rec, it was this parks department. And somehow from this parks department and this city hall, they built this incredible tapestry that was Pawnee. And they used Pawnee in small town America to comment on what was going on in America at the time. Social issues, gay marriage right at the beginning of the second season, the overregulation or regulation of government intrusion into people's decisions about what kind of size soda to buy or where businesses should go, the bureaucracy commentary and all of it. They used a tiny little milieu of a parks department to build this great kind of overarching series that was just, because they said it in Middle America and Indiana, it was about so much more than just about a tiny town in Indiana. It was a microcosm of everything that we kind of deal with, not only as a nation, but in terms of interpersonal relationships, in terms of the day to day and the things that we experience in our jobs and the career frustrations. And I mean, the fact that it did it so well and in such an expansive way out of that milieu is absolutely a legacy. And I think it's hard. I think when shows look at what they want to be, they're going to probably say, well, if we're a sitcom, are we trying to be a Parks and Rec? Like, is that our goal? Because Parks and Rec looked at The Simpsons, and when they realized pretty early in the series that these town halls were great to show the craziness of the citizens of the town and sort of in microcosm the citizens of the country, they said, okay, we can build like a live action Springfield. Like, we can do this. We can have it populated with these characters and families. And one of the things they talk about is the guy who runs the pawn shop that came out of the hole in the ground at one point.
Yeah.
His name's Herman Lerpus. He's got a name. And it turns
out there's a lot of Lerpuses in that town.
There's a lot of Lerpuses in that town. So they've conceived this huge universe. And I mean, that's not something that most sitcoms are getting into. Most sitcoms, even the good ones, are getting into, like, we're going to focus laser-like on these four or five characters, this specific situation, and all the funny that we can generate out of that. And we're going to give them stories that take them throughout different aspects of wherever they would be, but that's what our thing is going to be. Parks and Rec is so all over the place, but in like a perfectly executed way that I think if you're starting a new sitcom now, you're going to have to say, like, what am I trying to be? Am I trying to be Parks and Rec? Because Parks and Rec kind of thought, like, what am I trying to be? Am I trying to be The Office? Am I trying to be Cheers? I think Parks and Rec has moved us further down the road in terms of what our sitcoms can really and truly do in terms of bringing so many people in. And I think the second part of that is the guest stars, like the number of people that they truly were able to get to appear on the show is just not typical for a sitcom, because Leslie Knope had grandiose dreams that took her to Europe and to Washington. And because they wanted to create and did create this universe where it was totally believable that there was a guy in Indianapolis that had this crazy morning show. You could bring French Stewart in, or because there was somebody who, you know, was really against Ben Wyatt from Icetown, from his town. You could bring J.K. Simmons in. You could bring all of these characters in because you created such a giant universe that it really was seamless. And it was open to Pawnee's the city that can have a Dennis Feinstein in it, that can have a Joan Calamezzo in it, that can have these people Perd Hapley, like populating that it, you know, it's kind of different media and places that it can be that most sitcoms just aren't going to get there. Most sitcoms are not. I think of, like, you think about Springfield and The Simpsons. A lot of times The Simpsons guest star appearances, they're not as seamless. They don't necessarily fit as well into Pawnee. And the episode becomes about the guest star instead of being about the person that the sitcom is focusing on, that is on the sitcom week to week. But the best Simpsons cameos, of course, are the ones that are about the Simpsons character and that weave some guest star into their life. And Pawnee and Parks and Rec did that so wonderfully that it's a major legacy when it comes to sitcoms. It's going to be very difficult. And then I guess my final point would be just the ability to really hit it out of the park with an ensemble cast. And look, everybody from the Friends cast became famous, and everybody from the Friends cast was beloved, some more than others. Nobody likes Ross. Come on. But I'm just kidding. But
Come on.
Where's Monica? I don't understand why you wouldn't like me. But yeah, I think that this cast took unknowns in a lot of instances. I mean, Nick Offerman had been on Will and Grace. He had had a little bit of a kind of a profile, but it wasn't appearing in Variety like, hey, they signed Nick Offerman to play a key role on Parks and Recreation. Chris Pratt is a freaking movie star in blockbusters now. And he'd been on what, Torchwood or whatever, or what was it? I forget what show he was on.
Deadwood.
Deadwood?
No, Deadwood, yeah. Well, because Chris Pratt was on like Ever,
not Torchwood, but Ever something. Yeah,
yeah,
Ever.
but he was on Deadwood. Everwood.
Ron Swanson, and Nick Offerman was on Deadwood. Yeah. And you know, you've got all these people popping up that weren't really. I mean, Rashida Jones was big. Amy Poehler was big. Obviously, later on, they were able to bring in Rob Lowe, which was a huge get. But by and large, a lot of the people, Aziz, he's selling out Madison Square Garden now. Like that's not where he was when this show started. Like mm-hmm. This show has created some really major players, and Aubrey Plaza, same thing. I think right around the time that she was getting on Parks and Rec, she was in Funny People, and she was just kind of getting out there. And this is kind of her breakout, and we'll see where they all go. But I think that there, you could have a major. I was rewatching the other day, and freaking Kyle Mooney pops up in a 15 second cameo, just as somebody that Ron is interviewing for a job at the Parks Department when Aziz won't come back. And he's like interviewing these horrible candidates and making Aziz feel horrible for not coming back to the Parks Department. And Kyle Mooney's there. Kyle Mooney's a featured player, or he's in the main cast on SNL now, right?
Yeah, he's a feature player. Yeah.
Feature player. But I mean, I'm just saying, like, this show, because it was really so focused on that, when we could watch that show in 10 or 15 years, we're going to say, oh, that guy, that major Hollywood star, he was on the show for 7 seasons. He never left it. Like, that guy who's doing this other great thing, like, he's going to be doing, he was on this show for 7 years. And it's a shame, because I think a lot more people are going to come back and find this show now, or after it's off the air, as these people become more and more famous and involved in other projects. And I think if those people had been in the audience while the show was on, we might have gotten more Parks and Rec. But I think it's a major legacy for this show, what they've done with their cast, and to take it. And again, it's perfectly in keeping with the theme of the show itself, and what the finale really hit home is that these people all made each other better. And that without kind of the key pieces in the cog, and without this ensemble that they build, maybe none of them rise to the level that they got to as a result of the ensemble. Mm-hmm. And so the team was really important, and they all played a role in that team. And Parks is so meta in that way, and I love it. And I just love that the finale was able to really touch on what I think makes the show so incredible, both from a production standpoint and just from a legacy standpoint. And so I don't know. What do you think? What do you think that, I mean, beyond that, I mean, is there anything kind of more specific that you think that this show has generated, or that you think that we're going to look back on Parks and Recreation in 10 years and be like, that was the moment when things changed?
Yeah, I'll add two more points to yours, because I think you make three very valid points about the show. One is that, yes, the building of an ensemble is such a key thing. And I think there are a lot of shows that do that now. You know, you have like your New Girl, and you have all these shows that wanted to be Friends. How I Met Your Mother is an example. But one of the key pitfalls that a lot of those shows fall into is a TV trope called Flanderization, coined from The Simpsons, where when you try to build out your ensemble, a lot of characters become sketches of themselves. They become defined by one or two qualities. Parks and Recreation, I feel like, did the nega Flanderizing almost, of like they did the complete opposite. They took someone like Ron, who was extremely one note of like, I don't like this, I hate the government, where they were able to imbue a lot of qualities that Nick Offerman had in terms of his craftsmanship. They were able to give him a wife and children. They were able to give him opportunities for him to be actually emotional, for a man who doesn't show his emotions at all when we first saw him. Each of these characters has had their own rise and fall. They've had their moments where we've seen them at their worst and at their best. And it's been amazing to watch. And I mean, I have to give as many ovations as I can to the writing staff for being able to do that. And I think going forward, I think a lot of writers should look at that ensemble as an example of how to develop your characters, not necessarily regress them when you start running out of storylines. You need to, whether that's putting them in another job or putting them in a situation that's against everything they believe in, you know, you don't want to lean too much on the crutch of these one or two qualities. These were all fully fleshed out characters. You know, as much as some things may have fallen into the trope of like something's wrong and then Ron says a wise word and then everything's all right again, like they found ways to really make these characters three-dimensional. The other thing I'll say, or to wrap my point up, is that there is One of the best episodes of The Simpsons ever is an episode called Lisa Substitute. And
that's absolutely what I was thinking of when I said some of the episodes were better. I was absolutely thinking of Lisa Substitute.
Yeah. So Lisa Substitute has two kind of parallel trains running together that really represent The Simpsons in its golden age. And one of them is the humor of the Bart storyline of him running for class president. And then one is the complete humor, but also a complete emotional aspect of Lisa Simpson falling for her substitute teacher, Mr. Bergstrom, voiced by Dustin Hoffman. And one of the reasons why it's often called the best episode is because it really represented what The Simpsons had to offer in that time. Was like, yes, these were cartoon characters. Yes, these were drawn yellow people that were voiced by, you know, the same six people in a room, but it had this quality to really associate with human emotions in general. And I mean, there is a moment where Mr. Bergstrom is leaving on the train, and he gives a note for Lisa to open, and the note simply says, "You are Lisa Simpson." And I don't want to belabor this too much, but it is one of the most key moments in the development of that character. And I also feel like that describes Leslie a little bit as well, in terms of like, she is a little bit of the oddball out, you know, in this town that's full of from the most mundane person to, you know, the lurpuses of the Pawnee. They represent a whole microcosm of a spectrum of different personalities. And here's Leslie, who's kind of the odd person out. She's the only one that thinks this town is great. Everyone else kind of thinks it's a piece of crap. But, you know, she is Leslie Knope, and she is going to work her hardest to make sure that, you know, she's going to do the best she can, staying inherently true to herself, even though everything may be pushing against her, and it has for seven seasons. She is still going to be Leslie Knope. She's still going to be Lisa Simpson. And the show did a fantastic job, just like that one episode, of running these two trains parallel to each other throughout the entire series, to the point of where, you know, people have felt emotional about it before. I mean, you and I both probably cried multiple times at this finale. I know other people did as well. It was astounding, honestly, the day of the Parks and Rec finale, to see so many people that I didn't even know were Parks and Rec fan to begin with, like, show so much support of the show. And I mean, things like the AV Club and Hit Fix and everything went above and beyond the call of duty to do all this coverage of the show, for a show that was so low rated for its entire seven season run. It is astounding the effect that this show has had on the emotional qualities and the funny bones of the American community on the large. And I think with that, we are going to close the lid on the Mayor Gunderson-esque coffin that is Parks and Recreation, which I assume will be gone but not forgotten. So I guess to finish things up, Antonio, why don't you give out your Twitter handle and tell us a little bit about what's going on in Albuquerque and Kentucky in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I feel like Homer in Lisa's Substitute. I feel like I'm on the biggest roll of my life right now, Mike. I've been podcasting with Josh Wigler about Justified here on Post Show Recaps. If you watch the show Justified, or you know someone who does, we're having a great time with that. It is crushing its final season, just crushing, and we're enjoying that. We're really loving the feedback and really enjoying kind of working our way through what is a really incredibly well-written show as well. And then we're also talking on post-show recaps about Better Call Saul in New Mexico, myself and Rob Cesternino covering that again, yet another, what I feel to be an incredibly well-written show with a very unique perspective from Vince Gilligan, not only on Albuquerque as a city, but on sort of the kind of lower elements of society, criminals or would-be criminals, criminal attorneys, and everything that comes with it. We're talking about that live after each episode airs Monday night. So if you're interested in either of those shows, we'd love to hear from you. You can tweet at me with feedback about this show or any questions about any of those shows at AC Mazzaro. That's two Z's and one R. Mike, what do you got going on, man?
So I am very, very recently, as in like this weekend, going to start podcasting once again about Once Upon a Time. The second half of season four is going to have its midseason premiere on Sunday. So Kirk Clark and I are going to start our coverage of that. We're going to record this Monday night. We'll usually be recording on either Sundays or Mondays. So I'm very excited about that. You can always reach me at a Mike Bloom type on Twitter. And I guess we're going to leave it at that. Now, Antonio, we need a hashtag to lead these listeners in for listening at us talk about Parks and Recreation for more than 2 hours.
Is it more than 2 hours? Because I was caught up in making sure that I had the right spelling of Candace for the hashtag Candace Bergen.
Yes.
Are you okay with that, Mike?
I'm totally fine with that.
It's C-A-N-D-I-C-E. Mm-hmm. B-E-R-G-E-N. So if you listened all the way to the end, tweet at us with the hashtag Candace Bergen, and we'll know that that you liked what we had to say. And I'm just going to assume, Mike, if we don't get any tweets at a hashtag, look, nobody liked this.
Or nobody likes Candace Bergen. Either either way, we lose here.
Either way, we lose. Society loses as a whole, or we lose in microcosm.
Yeah, we don't want to become a Middle Korea anytime soon.
We don't want that.
So I just wanted to thank you guys for listening, whether this is your first time or you've been listening to Antonio and myself and Josh Wigler, who unfortunately couldn't join us tonight, talk about this final season of the series. As you can tell from the way we talked about it at the end, this was a series that was very near and dear to all of our hearts. And, you know, if you want more Parks, check out all the post-show coverage that's been going on. Alan Sepinwall did a bunch of interviews, stuff going on with AV Club. There was great interviews on Late Night with Seth Meyers that culminated in a viral makeout that you won't believe actually happened. There's a whole oral history of the progression of the show that was released as well. So the world is at your fingertips in terms of Parks and Rec. But for now, that's going to be the end of us in terms of Parks and Rec. But honestly, thank you guys so much for listening. Use hashtag Candace Bergen if you made it this far. Let's bring her back into relevancy in the 21st century.
If for some reason Candace Bergen trended, everyone would assume that she died. And that's a sad thing, but that would be hilarious if it trended because of this podcast. It would never happen, but it would be really funny.
Let's start our own death hoax now about Candace Bergen.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy. So thank you guys again so much. And this show is officially 5,000 candles in the wind.
Yeah, bye-bye, little Sebastian.
Take care, everyone. Bye.